Committee will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Today we have a presentation on student safety status and recommendations. We have a panel of four presenters. We also will hear two bills presented by Senator Bonhoff. In addition, I wanted to remind everyone of the committee calendar. Tonight we'll be in Burnsville at 6 o'clock, and there's several other items that are there for your reference. We know that there are many night meetings now that are competing with the schedule. There will probably be some changes, but just let us know if there's a need for a change for a visit that might be contemplated for your own district. Also, you're all aware of a concurrent resolution that passed on the committee deadlines, and the focus is for the budget, and that would be to have our budget bill through Senator Stump's committee done by April 2. The Senate policy deadline is Saturday, April 14. The House is looking at this point for policy, March 23. What does that mean? Well, it means that we'll be picking up the pace quite a bit over the next several weeks in regards to whether there'll be a policy omnibus bill. That is to be determined. Could be, but right now the route will be to send things to the floor or to a requested committee. For example, Senator Bonhoff for the Advisory Readiness Board would be a candidate to go to Senator Rest's committee. Other items that do not have a fiscal impact could go in an omnibus bill, but could also go to the floor. Initially, the suggestion, if there's not a fiscal impact, will be for it to go to the floor. That does not mean it couldn't be entertained as an amendment for the finance bill or as a floor amendment. So there's a lot of options that are in play, and I am meeting weekly with our counterpart in the House, Representative Mariani, to see whether they intend to have an omnibus bill, but at this point for policy, but at this point it looks like most of the bills that have a fiscal impact will clearly be in Senator Stump's bill, as well as some areas of policy, which will be determined. Questions? Okay, we'll go to the presentation on student safety, status, and recommendations, and I'll turn the gavel over to Senator Rummel.
Good afternoon. Is this on? And welcome. I believe that we are going to start with Mr. or Ms. Carol Thomas, and then we have Michael Campion, Seamus O'Meara, and Tom Helfinger. And if you could just move one to the other, give your name for the record, and we're all ears.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is Carol Thomas. I am on staff at the Minnesota Department of Education, and I work with the team that has responsibility for school safety in the department. I'm going to give you just a little bit of background of the work in the department that preceded this task force, then talk through the task force's process, and then turn the mic over to the other, to the gentleman at the table for more detailed comments. Work on school safety in the Department of Education, of course, preceded the statute that called for this task force by a couple of years. The department has been working cross agencies very closely with the Department of Public Safety and the Department on Health on issues relating to school safety, but that work escalated in the wake of the two violent incidents that we had in Minnesota. So last about a year and a half ago, Commissioner Segrin and Commissioner Campion directed staff from the Departments of Safety and Education to come together, gather information on what was best practice in relation to school safety, what were the needs in our state, and to make recommendations to the two commissioners on what we could do to work more effectively and efficiently on behalf of staff. That cross-agency group had just started to meet and work when the legislature last year passed the statute requiring the All Hazards Task Force, which is the report that you now have before you. So the commissioners, Commissioner Segrin and Commissioner Campion, worked together on calling together the task force and then receiving and responding to their recommendations, and Commissioner Campion is here to speak for himself on his response to the recommendations. The task force was comprised of over 20 members, as were detailed in statute, with a couple members that the commissioner added to the task force that were beyond those required in statute. As one of the staff who supported the task force, I can say this was a very skilled, very experienced group of people. They knew what they were talking about. They had a wide range of experience in relation to all hazards planning, school safety, and emergency response. And to a person, they were all committed to the task before them. They met four times over the fall. They heard from a panel of school staff people from Duluth, Anoka, and St. Paul who were working on, had received federal emergency planning grants and were working on putting together district-wide emergency planning initiatives. They heard from members, task force members themselves, on issues related to emergency preparedness, to fire, responses to fire and fire prevention, and on issues related to other threats such as terrorist threats. And they also had the director of the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools in Washington, D.C. come to one of their meetings, and he talked to them about the best practices the department was seeing across the nation that they could consider as they were putting together their reports. In its final meeting, the task force met with Commissioner Segrin and with Commissioner Campion's stand-in, Assistant Commissioner Tim Leslie, and talked over their recommendations. And Commissioner Segrin told me today that I could tell the members that she supports all of the recommendations, and she has a couple details which I'll mention to you as we walk through the recommendations. So the task force ended its work in January, and the report was prepared, circulated to them, approved by them, and then submitted to you as you have it. In the legislation that was passed last year, there were five particular questions the task force was supposed to look at. Four of them had to do with teacher and school administrator competencies, whether some training should be required or specified or could be, and what kind of all-hazard preparedness competencies either existing teachers and administrators should have or should be included in teacher preparation. The task force's response to those four questions is seen on page 4 of the recommendation, and in effect, they're responding back to you. These questions need to be studied further. In their discussions with Mr. Modzelewski from the Federal Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools, they found agreement with the information that task force members were themselves presenting, and that is there is a wide range of training already available. It's just not clear yet which are the key elements of those trainings that school administrators and school staff should have in order to be able to effectively do all hazard planning. The fifth question was a question about ask the task force to look and see what federal resources are available or could be available in the future to support these kinds of activities, and the task force's response to you is there are resources available and they're detailed in the appendix of the report from the Department of Education, from SAMHSA, and from Homeland Security. All of these resources are diminishing in size, and the ones from the Department of Education, the Safe and Drug-Free Schools funds that every district in our state now can access, was cut last year by 21%, and the current recommendation of the Department of Education is to eliminate the funding to local school districts. So the response from the task force back to the committee is federal resources, while they are there, are only appear in the useful in the future to be useful to think about in terms of pilot grants or grants to a district here and there, but certainly not kind of not any kind of statewide effort. The task force then made recommendations in four areas, and I'm going to walk through them briefly, and I know that Mr. O'Meara and Mr. Heffelfinger both want to talk a little in a little more detail about a couple of the recommendations. The first recommendation is that the state establish a formal, dedicated Minnesota School Safety Center. It is Commissioner Segrin's request, and the task force agreed with her that this center should be located in state government and should not be external to state government. And the thinking behind that was that resources are, as you will notice as you go through the report, scattered throughout state government. So there are resources in the Department of Education, in public safety, in the Department of Health, and in other agencies. And the most efficient way to pull those through the table, the commissioner believed and the task force agreed, was to keep the leadership for school safety in state government. The task force sets a date of recommending that this center be established no later than July 1st, 2008. So the task force gives the commissioners well over a year to continue to look at what is best practice in other states, what's working in other states who are set up much the same and have the same kind of resources we are, and then decide on what a good structure for that agency would be. The advisory task force did believe that their work wasn't finished and that the departments benefited, and we agree with that with the input from the task force. So the task force recommended that even though the statute ended their term February 15th, they asked that the legislature extend their term until a school safety center can start in a formal advisory board can be put in place in relation to that center. The second recommendation is the area that the task force recommends that the Departments of Education, Public Safety, and Health do more study and identify more information. One is what actually are best practices in relation to school safety assessments, and that's assessments where individuals go on-site to school districts and look at their physical plant, their school culture, their curriculum, and make recommendations for improvement. There's a wide variety of these being done across the country, and the task force would like to see better information on which of these are effective models for the state to follow. The second one relates back to that. These school safety assessments oftentimes result in increased capital expenditures for districts, and the task force wanted to get a better understanding of what the range of expenditures school districts might be looking at if, in fact, they started to do school safety assessments more widely than they're done now. The third one asks for more information and more study in relation to data privacy practices, especially the sharing of information on individual students between law enforcement and school districts in relation to threat to safety. And then the third one relates back to the four questions asked in the statute, and that is, what are the effective trainings and required competencies that the state should put in place in relation to all hazards planning? The third, their third recommendation has to do with changes they are recommending in existing state statutes. The first one is to the crisis management policy. And while there was a lot of discussion in this task force about increasing the number of required drills in school districts, the task force, in the end, stayed with the number that is in statute right now. It had been changed just last year. Agreeing with Commissioner Segrin that it would be wise to let districts first get used to doing the level of drills they are now required to do before anyone increases that number. But it does change the language a little bit to add a required school bus drill that is in a different statute to this statute as well, so that school districts could more easily see the whole list of drills that they're now required to do. The second change is to existing statute that requires a school pre-assessment team, and this change would change the title of that team to include all health and safety returns and concerns and the scope of considerations that a school pre-assessment team should look at. And then the third one While not specifically saying by how much, the task force believes that the school safety levy, which districts now are levying almost 100% of their allowed amount, should again be increased to allow districts to have a way to cover some of the costs that the new costs that they're seeing in relation to all hazards planning and school safety programming. The fourth one suggests areas that the legislature could consider new funding, and there were four areas. One is a grant program that would help school districts, if they needed, apply for resources, short-term resources, to cover any expenses related to the expansion of their school pre-assessment team. And they especially talked about required trainings that might occur in that instance. The second one talks about, again, some kind of grant fund or fund that school districts could access to actually conduct school safety assessments. The third one relates to a federal program that a small number of districts in our state have competed for from the Federal Department of Education, not competed for, have received. And these are funds that are granted to districts that experience some kind of crisis, whether it's a flood or a school shooting. It's short-term funds that districts can then use to address unplanned for but necessary expenses that result from that crisis. And then the fourth one would be a competitive grant application, and that's again patterned on the federal emergency planning program, and it would allow districts to apply for funds to do district-wide, region-wide, comprehensive, all hazards emergency management planning. So those are the, in a very brief walkthrough, those are the recommendations of the task force.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Senator Saltzman.
Ms. Thomas, was there any discussion with the intermediate school districts? There are three intermediate school districts in the metropolitan area, and they are continuing to serve students with high needs, and some of them have behavior issues. It's not just an issue, I understand, of what's happening within the school, but some of the people from outside who are attempting to enter buildings. And currently, they are not able to assess their own safe school levy. Has there been any discussion on how you might deal with them? I don't think I saw anyone on your task force.
Madam Chair, Senator, no, there wasn't anyone on the task force specifically speaking for intermediate districts. Because of the short time this task force worked, they targeted their conversations to public school districts. They did not have time, very much time, to look at what special needs charter schools might have, and they only had a very brief discussion about all hazards planning and safety services in relation to out of school time use of school buildings. So they had a list of other areas that they felt needed discussing, which is why they came with the recommendation and the offer to serve longer should the legislature see fit for them to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Tahan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question. In the course of the work that the committee did they do any evaluation of how these issues are addressed in the non-public sector of education? I mean, I'm assuming that there are similar kinds of concerns that other schools have, and I don't know how they do it either, but is there been any attempt to try to assess that or understand what they're doing and whether what?
Madam Chair, Senator, again, no. And it was more due to lack of time. Several of the bills that do relate to school safety do talk about non-public schools as well as public school districts. So the task force was aware that they are within the scope of concern and intention, but they just did not have time to get to those issues as well. We did have, and you will see in the appendix of the report, some of the information that the cross-agency task force had put together for the commissioners prior to the task force were surveys of law enforcement personnel and public school district personnel, asking them how well they thought they were prepared or were already doing crisis planning and emergency planning. So there are some surveys in the appendix of the report that you can see, and they called for more training, more resources, more information on best practices.
Commissioner Campion.
Madam Chair, members, Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. Ms. Thomas did a very good overview of the results of the task force, and I certainly would like to thank all of the task force members for their work the past year, particularly the two task force members that are here, Mr. O'Meara and Mr. Heffelfinger, who did some wonderful work, and the results of the task force are very significant. We're here to support the bill and support the recommendations of the task force. The recommendations fill a very serious need out there in school districts and in law enforcement. There are a number of different principles and concepts that we have collectively and collaboratively that we have learned over the last several years that really do make a difference in school safety. And if we can have a center and develop assessment tools and other best practices and get that information out to school districts and law enforcement, and encourage law enforcement and school districts to sit down now before any incidences do occur, it'll certainly create an environment that is much, much safer than what exists now. Some school districts, Madam Chair and certainly members, are more advanced than others. The opportunity to provide some consistency across the entire state is a very noble cause and would create an environment that provides an opportunity for a safer environment for all of the students. We would be very pleased at the Department of Public Safety to continue to work with task force members on this project and also the Department of Education.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I'll answer any questions that may occur later on. Otherwise, I will turn the microphone over to one of the two distinguished gentlemen to my left.
Are there any questions of the commissioner? Earlier in the remarks, it was indicated that federal resources are diminishing and that there's not sufficient dollars for a statewide effort. How would that affect the establishment of a safety center?
Madam Chair, as I understand the governor's recommendation, he has a couple $100,000 in for the biennium. It would be to start out with one full-time equivalent and some additional money to develop and promote a website and to do some collection of additional information on a national basis to try to secure the best practices available, get that information out to local school districts and law enforcement throughout the state of Minnesota. So the money that is not there doesn't affect, as I understand it, what the governor is proposing in this area as a result of the task force recommendations.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Campion, having not seen, you mentioned a bill, but I don't think we have a bill before us, and I haven't seen supporting language to the governor's budget recommendation on this, but is the center creating kind of a new independent entity, another little bureaucracy, or is it a way of organizing within either your department or Department of Education to just give some focus to this task?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, frankly, I haven't seen the bill either. I understand a bill is being it either has been written or being developed, but conceptually I understand pretty clearly from the governor's recommendation that it would be housed at the Department of Public Safety. It would be a virtual reality center versus a location, another bureaucracy, and that it would work with the task force members as needed that exist now and also the Department of Education. So it would be incorporated into the Department of Public Safety, and the Department of Education and the Department of Public Safety would work jointly on it.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, Mr. O'Meara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Seamus O'Meara. I am counsel for the Red Lake and Ricori school districts relative to the shooting incidents that occurred in 2003 and 2005.
Madam Chair, could you bring that mic closer? Thank you.
As I mentioned, I'm counsel for the two shooting incidents that occurred in Minnesota in 2003 and 2005. When you become involved in a traumatic event like a school shooting, either through representation of a school district or as an emergency responder, law enforcement member, or a family member that feels the direct effects of a school shooting, you have a unique perspective. And it is that perspective that brings me before this committee as part of the All-Emergency Task Force. I'd like to address my comments to what I think is the most important recommendation as part of our task force, and that is the establishment of a Minnesota School Safety Center. School safety is important. It was important to school districts before these shooting incidents. It is important afterwards. It will be important well into the future. School districts need a unified perspective, a unified approach, a unified direction relative to school safety issues. They need to know what the best practice is about protecting their physical school from an armed intruder. Is it a perimeter fence issue? Is it armed guards? Is it getting involved in these kids' lives in the hallway, discussing with them what they're doing before and after school or during school? Is it a combination of all of that? It is a school safety center, our task force believes, that can handle best practices and provide some direction to school districts, both here in the Twin Cities and outstate, to then allow school districts to internalize that information and best recommend internally how their school district and their individual schools can handle issues of school safety. Training and best practices. A dedicated budget for the school center is important. You cannot fund provide an unfunded mandate to school districts. It just provides an additional hurdle for them to overcome without any funding that allows for the establishment of appropriate training, appropriate resources to address school safety. The School Safety Center has an advisory board as part of our recommendation that consists of the Departments of Education, Public Safety, and Health. As well as the School Boards Association and other school administrators and others appointed by the commissioners that can properly address issues of school safety and provide some direction to the School Safety Center as it gets off the ground. And it will take some money. The governor's $200,000 may not be enough. It's up to the legislature, we believe, to work with the Departments of Public Safety, Health, and Education to see what kind of funding should be dedicated to this school safety center. It's a hugely important issue. It is the only way that I believe that we can properly take a look at school safety and give these schools some direction on a very important issue. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. O'Meara? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, Mr. O'Meara, a lot of school districts participate with the EXUs and that kind of stuff, and my understanding was that they did provide a lot of services for, you know, like asbestos abatement, safety in the schools, and I'm just wondering how they might fit into the big picture, you know, when you're talking about a safety center designed specifically for that. I mean, are we duplicating services?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, perhaps we are, but I think we should give it a try. Right now in Minnesota, you can go to an outstate school district with a very limited budget without a school resource officer, and you can get into discussions with school board members about the fact that they've cut 10-20 positions, and you're gonna ask them how they're going to properly protect their school. The EXUs, the cooperatives, yes, they can provide some guidance, but we need a center for school safety that can address all of these issues. And with a dedicated budget and a dedicated staff, a full-time executive director, so that somebody is charged with just what you're describing, getting information out. I don't believe that the EXUs or cooperatives or other associations out there can collect all this information and properly disseminate it. I just don't see it. I represent school districts for a living. I've been doing it for 15 years. I don't see focusing attention on an EXU or a cooperative is the answer. A school safety center with a dedicated budget, a dedicated full-time executive director is a good start.
Thank you.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to go, Mr. Mayor, I want to go back to what Senator Saltzman said when she brought up the intermediate school districts. I've had an occasion to tour the facility at Bren Road in Minnetonka, Eden Prairie area, and that is a, you know, place where very, you know, level, I don't even know what the level would be, but the students put the staff in grave risk often, and you know it takes a lot of courage for that those staff to work there. So I would just encourage that you play a significant amount of focus on these intermediate schools, because I know that that's where some of our greatest risks occur. In fact, there's a police officer assigned to this school all the time.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, you know the beauty of the public school system is that everyone is welcome. It's constitutionally mandated that public education will be provided to everyone. And so whether someone is a level five, a special needs student, or a talented and gifted student, they get a chance to be educated in Minnesota. School districts, in turn, are charged with the responsibility of providing an appropriate, safe environment for schools. And yes, there are intermediate school districts that are dedicated to just that task. In addition to Ms. Thomas's comments, I would add that the United States Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools has now taken on the issue of how to properly evacuate special needs students from a crisis event, how to properly protect them, how to properly address issues of school safety with them. We are approaching these issues from an all-hazards emergency management perspective. We are taking ideas from the federal government, tried and true methods, and we are seeking to implement them in Minnesota. In fact, Commissioner Campion and Tom Heffelfinger, when he was the United States Attorney for the District of Minnesota, used this federal protocol and used it well. And we believe that we should continue those efforts, and we should use the School Safety Center, a cross-agency center between three departments that are charged with improving our kids' lives, to work with everybody, public and private, so that we can together move forward and improve school safety.
Thank you.
Mr. Madam.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to go back to Senator Bonhoff's question, her question seemed to focus on the risk that some of the staff has. Do you see the center, and you're focusing on the students and protecting them, and I don't disagree with that, but we have circumstances where the staff are the great at risk, even perhaps at the hands of students. Do you see this safety center addressing those issues, or is it only focused on the protection of the students?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that should be one of our focuses. My comments were not intended to be exclusive to students. I represent school districts. I represent staff members within school districts. I think it's important to have that focus as well. And a school safety center can handle all of those issues and bring to bear the appropriate professionals in order to develop the best practices and best approaches to items that you're describing.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Heffelfinger.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. First of all, I want to commend the legislature for establishing this task force during its last session. And I want to thank Commissioner Segrin and Commissioner Campion for giving me an opportunity to serve on the task force. Again, my name is Tom Heffelfinger. I'm with the firm of Best and Flanagan. But I think what put me on this task force is that up until a year ago, I was the United States Attorney for the District of Minnesota. And in that capacity, I was the federal official responsible for the investigation and prosecution of the Red Lake school shooting on March 21st of 2005. Having walked through that school 2 days after the shooting and having met with all of the victims, families, and those who survived, let me tell you, as I think Seamus was modest, those of us who have personally experienced the horror of a school shooting will never forget it. It drives us, and I want to commend the legislature for keeping our response as a state to these tragedies alive. And let me be very clear with you. I am here, you are here, this task force was there to respect the memories of the nine people who died at Red Lake and the two people who died at Ricori. I do not want to go over all of the recommendations of the task force. Carol, I did it quite clearly. If you weren't aware, on page 5 of the handout is a what I would call an executive summary of the task force recommendations. I'd like to focus on 4 issues specifically. Following Red Lake, and I must say Red Lake occurred on a federal Indian reservation, and so unlike all other acts of school violence that we've been able to identify, this was a federal government law enforcement response in matters that usually fall almost exclusively to state government. And so we had an opportunity at Red Lake. One of the few silver linings in a horrible tragedy was the opportunity to see how well a response to a school shooting can occur when you bring together the best the feds have available and the best the state has available. And at Red Lake, there was an incredible outpouring both from the federal government and the state governments and all levels of state government, including local, to that response. Now, I'm not going to go to the immediate aftermath of the shooting, but it became clear to us who were responding to that tragedy that we as a state, both federal and local officials, state officials, needed to be better trained. And so we put together, in combination with Commissioner Campion, Commissioner Segrin, and my office when I was U.S. Attorney, a very successful 3-day training in Brainerd in October of 2005, focused on school safety and brought together the best people. That was a direct offshoot of Red Lake. We were all motivated by that. The next January, again, the 3 offices that I mentioned put together this brochure, which is available on the education website, and I'm confident that Commissioner Segrin would get any member of the committee who'd like it a copy of this marvelous brochure to help train people on how to avoid an act of school violence. But again, that was a direct offshoot of Red Lake and Ricori. Why we need a center is that time passes. People change positions. I'm no longer the U.S. attorney. Eventually, Commissioners Segrin and Campion will not be commissioners. And we would lose the working relationships that we developed out of tragedy if we do not have somebody in government on whose desk the buck stops when it comes to bringing together those resources that do exist in this country to protect our students and our staff. Senator Olson, I want to assure you that at least from this member of the task force, there was no doubt that our responsibility here lies as much to the safety of students or of school teachers and staff at schools as it does to students. Red Lake, we lost a staff member and we lost a teacher. The risks may be somewhat different, but in preparing for all hazards, that's why we call it all hazards. And the ability to have a center will allow us to bring together the best practices, both within the state of Minnesota, but also from outside the state, to more effectively protect our students, teachers, and our staff. I believe one of you, and a couple of you picked up on the issue of schools that don't fit the definition of a state high school or elementary school. We talked about intermediate schools, reference made to private schools. Let's be candid. In the last year, there have been more acts of student violence. A couple were committed by adults who came in, had no ties to the school. Another one, which occurred within the past 3 months, was an after-hours use of a school facility in the gym. There are issues which this state must address in order to enhance school safety for staff, students, teachers, and visitors that we could not accomplish during the period we had available to us in the task force. Well, I strongly advocate the extension of the task force's mission, at least until such time as we get the advisory task force up and running with the center. And let me give you an example of how this has worked even in the last 10 days. Those of us who were on the task force formed healthy respect for each other. And through an email dialogue that we had as recently as the last 10 days, there was a discussion about how to respond to the following situation. You've got a lockdown in your school for a live shooter situation. All of a sudden, the fire alarms go off. What do? Did you leave the kids in the lockdown, risking the fire? Did you take the kids out of the classroom to avoid the fire, risking the live shooter? There are protocols that have been developed in other parts of the country to address this issue. These are situations which we debated on our internet exchange, and these are not hypothetical, because Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold walked into Columbine with bombs with the intent of doing exactly what that hypothetical propagated, which is get the kids out of their lockdown through fire and explosives. One of the advantages of having the task force continue and then segue into a new advisory task force is the ability to respond and develop best practices for these real-world situations. Number third issue I'd like to mention. We don't have a recommendation as a task force. This is what I guess a lot of good lawyers do. We found a problem and then somebody else had to solve it. There is a longstanding policy of the state of Minnesota to respect privacy, to protect privacy, and yet at the same time to make public information available through the Data Practices Act. It's a key part of our recommendation is that the commissioners of Education, Public Safety, and Health, and eventually the center itself, focus on trying to address the conflict, if you will, between respecting privacy on the one hand and allowing the sharing of information sufficient to assess risk and prepare to prevent violence or other school hazards. We don't have an answer how to do this balance yet, but it definitely is something that needs to be addressed. Finally, and this was, I'll be very blunt, this was my personal reason why I wanted to do this, was because of what I learned at Red Lake. We strongly advocate the amendment of Minnesota Statutes 121A.26, which is a statute currently on the books that requires pre-assessment teams for chemical abuse issues. It was one of our strategies that if we can amend current legislation that has worked to fit the need that we have identified for all hazard safety, we should do it. We strongly recommend the amendment of that statute to make it all hazards pre-assessment team, including chemical abuse. And why? Because, quite frankly, all hazards, whether they are acts of violence, as we saw at Red Lake and Ricori, or other acts, generally are preventable. And they are preventable because a study of school violence shows that there is conduct that one sees frequently in people who present a threat to a school or to school staff, students, and teachers. There's a marvelous study by the United States Department or the United States Secret Service that studied every school shooting situation for a 25-year period up to and including Columbine that identified 10 behavior patterns that one could look to identify high risks of school violence and how one responds to them. And let me give you one that drives me because of Red Lake. In 81% of the acts of school violence where there's a shooting involved, somebody else knew about that before the act occurred. And that was true at Red Lake. And if we can establish, fund, and train pre-assessment teams who are on site in the school, who are there to listen, to hear, to take those warning signs that education and experience show us exist, to take those warning signs and deal with those kids in crisis, we can prevent school violence. So I thank you again for the opportunity to serve on the task force, and I stand ready for any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, and I would preface them by asking you not to view them as my being adversarial to what is obviously something we all feel deeply about and can be very emotional. So having said that, the center being placed in the Department of Public Safety seems very logical. This is my first exposure to the report and the recommendations. Will this be part of the public safety budget, or is it expected to be supported by the education budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson will be part of the public safety budget.
It will.
New money, my understanding, that it's a governor's initiative, new money, $200,000 of new money going to the Department of Public Safety for this activity.
And Madam Chair, I was reflecting as you were describing this. We've seen a variety. Our focus has been on these kinds of incidents that have happened within schools. And yet there are similar kinds of actions that are happening in other kinds of settings, and who knows where this might expand to. Do you see, is there something particularly unique to the school setting, or do you see this approach to dealing with these severe tragedies and their prevention taking on a broader scope at some point?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, first of all, I recognize that you care very deeply about this, and you have a fiduciary duty that you need to fulfill. So I appreciate any probing questions you might have. Bring them on. I think it's implicit in the issues that we've identified that have not yet been done, that we recognize that acts of violence or hazards committed against, be they fire, be they shooters, against schools, can be replicated in other kinds of public contexts, community centers, city halls, any place where there might be a large gathering of the public. It is, however, a tragic fact that school shooting situations have become recurring, and that there are people who are disturbed and suffer in the school environment at a higher level than they might. For example, one of the warning signs that the Secret Service identified is incidents of bullying as a high indicator of a victim of a bullying presents a high threat of becoming a school shooter. Similarly, acts of suicide or suicidal tendencies and ideations pose a high risk of being a school shooter. Unfortunate fact is that inside school environments, one will see these acts of bullying, these tendencies towards suicidal thoughts at a greater level than one might see at a school or at a community center or alike. And then lastly, when one studies the history of school shooting, one recognizes that kids learn from prior acts. We know at Red Lake that the shooter in that case studied Columbine. His act was not an Indian crime. It was an attempt to replicate at Red Lake what Harris and Claybold did at Columbine. So I speak for the task force in this, that we recognize that there are other similar situations that would benefit from what a school safety center can do, benefit from the preparations and the training, but we also recognize that schools, at least right now in our nation's history, are at greater risk than some of those other types of facilities and gatherings.
Madam Chair, is there another question, or could I just follow up with one more?
We're going to terminate this conversation in about 3 minutes because we have two other bills to hear. And so if we can keep our remarks tight, we do have to get the committee off to Burnsville. So about 3 minutes, if we could finish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A few years ago, it's quite a few years now probably, but a friend of mine sent me a copy of a NPR tape of the Westminster Town Forum that had a forensic psychologist speaking on, he was a person that evaluated people as to whether they were prepared to, you know, could stand trial based on having committed murder. And one of the things that kind of I listened to that tape several times, and I've mislaid it. I wish I could listen to it again. But one of the things that was said is that there was one common element in all of these cases, and you're searching your mind, what would that be? And it wasn't what I expected, but the common thread was humiliation. And I wonder if that you know, I don't think we've considered that in terms of the bullying kind of fits into it, and I don't know if there's other elements beyond that in this environment, but that has every time I see one of these going on, you wonder, what did they experience? They don't always carry out the murder of the person who humiliates, but they may try to get at somebody that would hurt that person in their process, like killing the children of the mate that is humiliating them.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Olson, that was probably Dr. Carl Malmquist, who used to be the forensic examiner for Hennepin County.
He was from California.
One of the things that came out of the Secret Service study is that there is no common trait. You cannot profile a school shooter. What you have to do is focus on behavior. And yes, there are patterns of behavior that, when combined with other patterns of behavior, elevate the risk presented by a child or somebody. But it would be a delusion. We would be deluding ourselves if we started focusing on trying to find a profile. And that word profiling appears a lot in today's law enforcement, at least. And it's true in this environment. You cannot profile a school shooter. What you can do is look for acts and behavior that are consistent with other school shooters and recognize that those behaviors require attention.
Thank you.
On behalf of the committee, I'd like to thank all of you for the excellent report that you've given. I understand its background and that when the bill will come before us, I imagine we will explore it more deeply. Appreciate the work that went into it and the passion that you bring to this important topic. At this moment, we will now move on to hearing Senate File 92. Senator Bonhoeff, would you please address the committee? And in the interest of time, I'm going to ask those who give testimony to limit their comments to between 3 and 5 minutes, because we have quite a few people, especially on the second bill, who wish to testify. So please keep your comments brief. If your comments have been made by someone else, it's not necessary to repeat them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beginning with Senate File 92, and I will first review the bill, and then I will ask my witnesses to testify, Karen Cadigan here from the Director of Outreach and Public Policy, the Center for Early Education Development at the University, and Zoe Nicolai, Public Policy Director for Ready for K. Just some background on this particular bill. We meet as an Early Childhood Caucus, which is a bipartisan group from both the House and the Senate. And in fact, last summer, the governor had an all-day task force meeting with a much larger group, but of stakeholders around early childhood. And one of the things that came out of this day was that many of the participants felt that we wished the governor actually had a cabinet position for early childhood, like we do as a commissioner of, you know, K-12 education. So we did not end up going in that direction on that day, but one of the things that has been brought forward is the idea of having a state advisory board on school readiness. And this would do some important things. I think it would bring many fragmented programs and directions under the umbrella of one accountable group. And this bill was actually already heard in the House, and so I'm offering the amendment is the A1 amendment. And the A1 amendment gets this bill in the shape that I'd like it to be in based on some feedback that was given during the House testimony.
I believe the amendment will be passed out just. Yeah. It's coming around the table now.
Specifically, if you will look at this state advisory board in the original bill, talks about it being appointed by the governor, and Some people felt that that would be too political, that if all of the members were appointed by the governor, and so the A1 amendment says that the advisory board would be appointed by the majority leader and the minority leader from the Senate, along with the Speaker of the House and the minority leader in the House, so a group of four in a bipartisan way. And then, in addition, we've added some people to the governor or to the advisory board. So I will now ask my testifiers to talk a little bit about the board and its genesis and why we think it's important.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Karen Cadigan. I'm the Director of Outreach and Public Policy at the University's Center for Early Education and Development. And I would be remiss if I didn't comment briefly on the previous testifiers' comments. I think that one thing that's nice about talking about early childhood is that it offers a lot of hope, and that the focus of a lot of the conversations that have been happening around the state, whether it be strengthening programs or strengthening parents or strengthening outcomes, have to do with prevention. So that just couldn't let that slip by without mentioning it. I have been involved in a variety of reasons in the state for the purpose of pulling together information about the early childhood system. And I don't know about you, but it's a little bit siloed. It's a little bit patchy. There's a lot of I heard someone once compare our sort of non-system of early childhood education and care to a quilt that needed some better sort of patching together. What has happened to date in Minnesota is in some ways an example of the best that Minnesota can offer in terms of combinations of private and public and family input for young children. I have to say, though, that the states where early childhood is moving forward in an efficient way, in an intentional way that's responsive to parents, responsible to taxpayers, and accountable to the children in the programs, each of those states has the governor's office involved in some manner, in addition to legislative activities. So some sort of an advisory committee to the governor is really, in Minnesota, is really a natural extension, I think, of the couple years worth of work of the Early Childhood Caucus, in addition to some of the great work of the foundations. One of the great advantages that this might offer is another venue for consensus building. I think that we caught just a glimpse of that this summer. I don't know how many of y'all were at the governor's summit, but we really caught just a glimpse of it, and it seems that adding this component wouldn't necessarily be more government, but would help focus government in an appropriate way, providing some oversight as the early childhood system continues to grow. Thanks for hearing my comments today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have a question.
I'm sorry, Senator.
I just want a point of clarification. The author has an amendment before us, and I don't know if you wanted us to take action on the amendment before we move on to your witnesses, or I'm just a little confused about it.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Senator Torres Ray. I move the A1 amendment.
The amendment has been moved. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment has been accepted. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Bond.
Zoe.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Zoe Nicolai, the Director of Public Policy at Ready for K, and here to testify today on this bill before you that it would establish a state advisory board on school readiness. It's an issue that of governance, one of which Ready for K is very interested in. We think that it can help guide the development in Minnesota of an effective coordinated early childhood system. I just wanted to give a little background for those of you who may not know that for the past 4 years, Minnesota has been one of, along with four other states, been participating in a national initiative called the National Build Initiative. It's now actually grown to nine states. that have been funded through the National Early Childhood Funders Collaborative. And each of the states that are participating, it also, in addition to us, it includes Illinois, Ohio, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Michigan, Oklahoma, and Washington. We get support from the BUILD initiative in each of our states to bring together key stakeholders to look at planning an early childhood system, the very things that Ms. Cadigan was referring to. And the focus of the National BUILD initiative has been upon the first 5 years of life, with a broad conception of systems building, meaning a system of systems, really, that includes early care and education, health, family support, and early intervention. In Minnesota, Ready for K has been the grantee for the BUILD initiative, and we've been working over the past 4 years with a broad array of stakeholders to really look at what those gaps are, how that patchwork quilt might be really sewn together. And one of the things we have focused on is this issue of governance, of what an early childhood governance system would look like. We've researched what other states are doing, and we've participated in some national symposiums on governance. And one of the things that we brought back to Minnesota was this thought, this issue of governance, of how a state assesses the needs of children and families, then manages their early childhood programs for positive child outcomes, then coordinates with local community efforts. It's a complex but very important issue. In Minnesota, we do not have a formal early childhood education governance system, either statewide, broad council, or local infrastructure that would define what's the role of the state, what's the role of local communities in building or managing an early childhood system. On a statewide level, we have several different state agencies, and primarily the Department of Human Services, the Department of Health, and the Department of Education, that have responsibility for different parts of the system, and coordination is not always what we would hope it would be. And at the local level, primarily through efforts of foundation leadership and funding, there are many Minnesota communities who have, without any state involvement or oversight, they have established local early childhood coalitions that are focusing attention on and implementing elements of an early care and education system at the local level. You're probably familiar with these efforts through the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations. The MIFs, as we call them, were funded for those of you who may not know what the MIFs, these initiative foundations are, have been funded for, I think, over 15 years by the McKnight Foundation to develop economic, to provide foundation support for economic development in greater Minnesota. And about 4 years, about the same time that Minnesota became a member of the BUILD, or participated in the BUILD initiative, these six initiative foundations came together and said, what's the one issue we think that could most promote economic development in our regions? And they chose early childhood. And so they have been embarking with their own foundation funding, with local funds, and with support from the McKnight Foundation, in working with over 64 now early childhood coalitions in greater Minnesota. And that represents over 150 local communities. They've been gathering information on the strengths and gaps in their local community, raising awareness, creating an early childhood vision for their community, and implementing local strategies. But we do not have a good mechanism for systemically linking what's happening at the community level that could inform state-level system-building work, and vice versa. Each of the departments are doing very good work in many instances, and that work needs to get disseminated back to the local groups. Last summer, Ready for K convened a two-day planning retreat called Building Connections. And the purpose of this was to explore this state and community systems level, and particularly the issue of governance. Over 90 people from state agency staff, many people from the MIF early childhood coalitions, providers, school district representatives, and other attended and came to a consensus on the beginnings of an early childhood governance system for Minnesota that they thought would utilize the strengths of both the local communities and state government. And the model was two-part, the development of a statewide, and that group thought it should be mostly either private or quasi-governmental governing entity that would oversee and assure a coordinated effective system. And then at the local level, we'd have early childhood coalitions. They recommended that the statewide governing entity and the community coalitions would be directed by agreed-upon goals and desired outcomes for school readiness and guiding principles that could include parent choice, first of all, cost-effectiveness of early childhood strategies, cultural competency, and sustainability. Our next steps were going to be to convene a smaller group of this group that was at the retreat to develop a more detailed recommendation for a statewide governance system. And now this bill kind of puts our work on a little bit more of a fast track. So I guess what I can say is that Ready for K is very interested in working with Senator Bonhoff in giving the bill a very broad review of the people who attended that retreat. We think we can learn a lot from what other states are doing. There's some excellent resources. Report on building an early learning system, the ABCs of planning and governance structures, outlines 36 states who are doing some kind of a state approach to governance, setting up a governance system. So we offer our help and support the work that this bill would embody.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I also would like to add just a couple things. One is there is a fiscal note associated with this bill, and so I'd like to introduce that for the record so that the bill can be referred to finance after this. Do you have that, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And then with regard to the advisory board itself, in order that we do make sure to include all of the interested stakeholders, the positions that we've added in the amendment is we've added somebody from MELF, and I think that that's important because we know that they have been charged with making sure that we are doing early education to the best of our ability. A school counselor and the Commissioner of Health and Services. So those were the positions that were added. And then I'm interested in always hearing from anybody who's either for or against the bill. And so based on some feedback that I've gotten already from the community, I'm going to offer one additional amendment, and that is on line subdivision 3 on line 2.29, if we just remove the word behavioral, I believe that that will alleviate. There was some concern that the way that this particular section was written, that it mirrored a passage in another bill that had a different intent than I'm trying to propose here.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. Senator Bonhoff's amendment has been made. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you. I can now take questions.
Questions for Senator Bonhoff? Senator Han?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is for is it Nikolai? Sorry. And I just want a clarification, and maybe I misheard, but it seems as you were making your comments, you were kind of summarizing and saying that the goal would be to set up a governmental system to facilitate early childhood education. Is that really the intent? Or, you know, right now we don't really have this governmental structure. It's a fairly loose, as been described, and there may be some positives and negatives, but I just want to make sure I'm clear on what the intent here is if we're trying to move away from that to something that is more structured and managed by government.
I'm not talking about adding the issue of governance. I think doesn't necessarily mean another state agency or setting up a big bureaucracy, but it does mean, I think, the state taking leadership and having a role and having some kind of body that will have oversight, would define what is it that we want in Minnesota in terms of outcomes for children. Particularly probably 0 to 5 or 0 to 8, the early care and education years that would get as many children as we can ready for kindergarten. And so the second part of my testimony was to I think it's not in this bill, but to raise the possibility that when you're thinking of governance as how a state works with its local communities, how do you set up a structure for some kind of communication between local communities and the state that can inform work in both instances.
Thank you.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for either of you, please. I am a little concerned about some of the work that we do with appointing boards and groups to deal with this issue. And I want to ask for your patience in listening to what I'm going to say. But in the early 90s, we appointed the Action for Children Commission. Then we established the Children's Cabinet. Then we established the Legislative Commission on Children, Youth, and Their Families. Then we established the Pew Charitable Trust. And on and on, then we have MELF. And part of what it is really concerning to me is that we have not been able to put in policy or in language something very concrete that says after these boards submit recommendations to policymakers, we're going to take action on this. And so I am quite surprised that you don't have that language here. You're asking us to support your recommendation to establish a board. And immediately my reaction is, haven't we done that before? Haven't we established boards before that have submitted recommendations to this body? And what have we done with it? And so with all the respect to the author and to the witnesses that are before us, what I would like to say is that we need a stronger language in this bill that really ask this bodies, the committee and the Senate and the House, to really do something with these recommendations. We're going to establish, your recommendation is to establish this cabinet at the governor's level, and I think that's very good. We need that kind of action at that level, and we need staff at that level helping us. But at the end, I want to make sure that those recommendations or suggestions or reports that come out of there come here immediately so that we can take action. And so I don't know if you care to. I know, Ms. Nicolai, you have been involved in several issues and have been part of most of these commissions and have been in one way or another involved as a staff member or an interested party. And I don't know what makes this different and how can we strengthen the language to make sure that we do something with these recommendations, because I'm concerned about that.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres Ray, I appreciate the comments that you're making. And I, too, have had some frustration. For example, we have MELF out there doing their research, and then at the same time we're offering a very expansive early childhood education bill that's doing similar things to what we're having MELF investigate, and we still don't know if what MELF is, you know, investigating is going to work. And so the thing that I liked about this is that we have identified that we do not have a system of bringing these disparate groups together, identifying what works, and a system for implementation with accountability. And I look at this as the possibility, and if we're missing some language that gives them that authority, I'm open to amendments. If there's something that you would like to offer, you may want to think about that. In addition, I wish that we actually had a cabinet-level position, because I think that we're all grappling with the enormous need that early childhood education, you know, it's not something that we can solve by a few people sitting around a table. It's going to take some real research and collaboration and long-term strategic thinking. Where do we want to go as a state? And so to Senator Hand's question, too, you know, the question is, well, is this creating government? It's probably not. You know, could we use government? We probably could in this area. So this is maybe a step towards that, and I'm open to further recommendations.
Madam Chair, I have a follow-up.
Senator Torres-Ray, then Senator Olson.
Senator Bonoff, I think that this is, you're moving in the right direction, and I really commend you for the work that you're doing. I really appreciate your invitation to offer an amendment. The only concern that I have is that I don't want this as an open-ended kind of a decision. You know, you appoint somebody, and then they work until 2013, I guess it is. But we don't have any specific language in here that really tells us, you know, when they do their work. My preference will be that every year this group comes before the legislature with recommendations for action so that we can immediately help these organizations and establish that structure, because I agree with you. That's precisely my concern, that we haven't had really strong language in policy that says after they do the work, we're going to take action on it. And so it continues to be a recommendation, and they come year after year after year just to submit recommendations, and we don't take action on it. So I would like to I thank you for your invitation to offer an amendment. I don't have a language, you know, prepare for it, but if possible, I would like to offer an amendment soon that requires that this specific group, a board, will submit recommendations and for actions, to take action by the legislature.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
could I, just checking the protocol, would it be possible for Senator Torres Ray to work with me on the side between now and the time when this, you know, gets looked at in education finance to develop an amendment? Would that send?
Mm-hmm. That would be fine.
Thank you.
Did you still have a question? Mm-hmm. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reflecting and, you know, even noting my own co-authorship on this, but in so many fields, there is a vocabulary that develops around a particular issue that if you step outside of that, you can see different interpretations to what, in fact, is being said or being promoted. And what I'm getting at here is, you know, we do have in statute that the parent is the primary, it has the first responsibility for the education of their child. And I did hear parent mentioned a couple of little tiny places, but there's an assumption when you talk about creating a system and governance that we are in fact promoting government kind of taking over that part and package of parents' responsibility. And if we're honest, or if we do any checking, there's an awful lot of children that are being well prepared for schooling in a variety of settings, and some parents that are even committed to doing that education themselves and are proving to be quite effective in creating good citizens that are capable of doing quite well in our society. So I wish we could have more attention to that, because I think there's an assumption that these, both in terms of the representation on this board, granted, many of them are parents, but they're also people with vested interests in many cases with the concept of a government-managed system along the way. In terms of the ultimate outcome, you know, we're hearing as a group. I was not able to participate in that governor's retreat, but I have been a part of that leadership one. And one of the things that was a common agreement is recognizing that we have a very diverse array of choices for parents today,
yeah,
and that we shouldn't be taking actions that are going to undermine either the parental choice or the various folks who wish to deliver services, but rather to try to be helpful to parents with information and measures of quality that they would look for toward the end of making the choices to improve their children's education prior to the traditional school time. So, as you pursue this, I think we need to be attentive to that, because it appears that, you know, when that we're doing something for all.
Yes.
And we're going to try to govern and take away that responsibility, which is, I think, we ought to be encouraging more parental responsibility than attempting to undermine it. As we go forward here. And I'm not making any accusation here because I know how easy it is because when we feel very strongly and are working in a given area, and we may be focusing on some targeted, there are folks that need this help and there are children that need these kinds of services, but we ought not to lose that perspective by the magnitude of what we may be tackling and proposing. So that just a
Senator Bonhoeff.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I agree with you, and I remember at one of my first early childhood core leaders conferences, we were presented an approach, and I can't remember the researcher's name. You can let me know, but it was around looking at all policy through the lens of putting families first. And so you couldn't even evaluate a policy without looking at, does this promote making sure family comes first and empowering parental choice? Excuse me, Ms. Cadigan, Madam Chair, if you would tell us the name of that.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoeff is referring to a tool called the Family Policy Impact Checklist, which is a little bit of a cumbersome name, but its aim is to, in the way that we would evaluate the economic impact or the environmental impact of a policy, to think about what impact does a policy have on families. And there are five domains that it sort of lays out to review. And one of them is, does the policy usurp or strengthen family responsibility? Another one is, does the family provide particular attention to those at most risk? Another is, does the policy build relationships within the family? So I'd be happy to provide copies for members. It can be a very useful tool. And just an additional comment I would like to make as Senator Olson, I appreciate your ongoing attention to the role of parents. I do think that for those of us that are entrenched in thinking about these issues all the time, we certainly do put parents first, but it may not always seem that way because we're talking about the programs. But part of my work is serving at the right hand of President Brunix on the ITASCA projects, Early Childhood Workforce. And one of the topics that came up frequently in those discussions is the need to better leverage all the fantastic things that are happening in Minnesota's private sector. You probably know that childcare in Minnesota is a bigger industry than corn. It's over $2 billion, largely run completely on its own, and certainly doesn't need government takeover. But things may run, and again, in states where a little more attention has been given, things may run more smoothly and more efficiently with less gaps and less overlap if there is more governance, not governance of what families should do. I don't think we ever want to be in the business of doing that, but governance of what is already happening and how can we best maximize and leverage resources from all different sectors.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, what I would offer, and I was wondering if you might be able to work with me on the side also, is that we actually put some language in the bill that this is that would say the advisory board must consider, as it makes its recommendations, putting all policy through the lens of putting families first.
Madam Chair, thank you. Even the term governance is one of those words that has a meaning to a public that it may, we may see it differently and may not interpret it the way that you are doing that. I just want to share one brief anecdote. It's a number of years ago, I was on the steering committee with the Education Commission of the States, and it happened to be when Governor Jeanne Shaheen from New Hampshire was the chair and had picked as her theme for her term of service the early childhood. And we were on a kind of a teleconference with, I can't even remember, some government agencies, and it was always talking about all children, and I happened to be sitting next to her, and I said, you know, the particular point that was being made, I said, you know, would kind of rule out family daycare, is that your intent? And she said, no, no. And she immediately changed her language and tried to refocus that, because, but it's a tendency that we get caught up in. And I just would encourage, I think, all of us to be careful of how we do that, at the same time that we are trying to help those at risk and do it in a meaningful and efficient, effective way. Thanks.
Thanks. Senator
Saltzman.
Yeah. I've been chair today during the smoking ban, so I know what it's like. So thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Bonnef, I want to tell you that as a co-author of this bill, what I find most exciting is that we are talking so much about early childhood, and so many different organizations and agencies and groups are trying to focus on this. And this is a way that we can be more effective and efficient, because I see on the second page, lines 2.10 through 2.13, it talks about how can we avoid duplication and fragmentation of service, enhance public and private investment. So to me, what I like about this bill is that we, you know, can certainly add some things to make sure that it feels really comfortable to people. But I think it's going to make sure that as we move ahead and as we start to invest in these programs, that we do it in a very collaborative way, and we aren't duplicating services, and we're focusing on what's best for families and children. So I thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Is there anyone else from the audience that wishes to make a comment? That would be Dr. Karen Ephraim. Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Ephraim.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, a pediatrician, and a policy analyst for EdWatch. And I want to say that we very much appreciate this bill's approach to finding a more publicly accountable manner to investigate and recommend policy regarding early childhood. And I also want to commend Senator Bonnef for her willingness to listen to all sides on that. And I would only say that while it is very important and commendable to do good and to deal with early childhood, that you just pay really close attention to the research from all groups, not only groups that have a vested interest in these kinds of programs. And just two things really briefly. One is American fourth graders, when the evidence of early childhood is most apparent, outscore on international assessments of reading, math, and science. They outscore children from universally preschooled countries in all of those areas. It is not until eighth grade that American children fall to the middle of the international academic heap, or 12th grade when we fall to near the bottom, and that points much more to a problem in the K-12 system rather than a crisis in early childhood. And the other thing that I would say is that no study has shown long-term academic benefit of early childhood programs beyond the third grade. So while it is important to investigate these things and to make recommendations, please pay attention to the research and do not overact. And then I would also commend Senator Hahn for his concern about governance, and Senator Olson as well, and Senator Bonnef for her willingness to be concerned about that, because the system that we have isn't nearly as fragmented or in crisis as sometimes we are led to believe. And it is very, very important to pay attention to the impact on the potential for growing government and undermining parental control, which has been not only in this state but in this nation for hundreds of years and is a matter of both tradition and settled law.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Senator Torres-Ray.
I'm ready to move for adoption. Is that okay, or you want to?
Senator Banoff, what is your desire and how you want to move this?
I move to lay this on the table for to re-refer it to education finance.
To re-refer to education finance? No, I think we have to re-refer to state and local operations.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have to re-refer to state and local governance because of the fact that it's got an advisory board component within it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Banoff, did you read Senator Rest's? There may be some elements that...
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, yes, there is some work to be done when it gets to that committee based on Senator Rest's handout.
Chair, just before I forget, before we move this on, thank you. Wanting to know if there was an offer made by Ms. Cadigan to provide the committee with the family policy impact checklist, and I would just like to get on record that I would like to get a copy of that, and perhaps other members would as well, so thank you.
Thank you, Senator Tehan. I think we would all appreciate that. So Senator Banoff has moved that Senate File 579, as amended, be recommended. I'm sorry. Senate File 92. I'm looking at the wrong page here. As amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the state and local operations on oversight. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you. Okay, my next bill.
Your next bill. And I'm looking at the time. We're probably going to begin to have the background on this bill, and we'll probably have to finish hearing the bill on Wednesday.
So I would like to, as I give you the background, ask that Gail Southwell and Emma McCready, Joyce Baird, and Kristen Christopherson join me at the table. I have an amendment as well with Senate File 579, so I'm offering the A1 amendment on this bill as well.
The amendment is being passed around to the committee members.
This bill that you have before you is the bill with regard to ECFE and kindergarten screening. My amendment. Okay, very good. I'd like to just take us through the bill. So, we currently have the ECFE programs, and so the things that are being added or changed that this bill does is we begin with, we know that we don't have an unlimited amount of funds for ECFE, so this bill makes sure that we are using our funds by first making sure that this is for parents and the children who may be at risk of not being ready for kindergarten. And by at risk, there's, you know, much discussion around what is at risk. And for the purposes of this discussion, I'm assuming at risk is referring to free and reduced children who would meet the free and reduced lunch standard. You go on to the next page.
Excuse me, Senator Banoff. Are you going through the amendments to
I'm actually going through the bill. Well, in terms of the, we haven't gotten to where an amendment would take effect. Okay. So now if you turn to the next page. Here we say that to ensure early childhood family education programming is accessible for all families in the state, the department must develop and implement a program accountability plan that focuses on the race, ethnicity, and income demographics of the families being served by ECFE and requires corrective actions for those programs not meeting accountability standards. Again, we know everybody loves ECFE, but we want to make sure we are targeting the families who are most at risk and most in need of these programs. Within this bill, we are restoring the per pupil fee to its original 2003 levels. So last year we did move from 104 to 112, and now we are returning to the $120 for fiscal year 2008. And later times, the greater of, we went from 150 to 180. The number of people. So we're expanding our reach and expanding our per pupil basis. And we all know that all of our school districts have, all over the state, have asked us for this. And I know going to Pequot Lakes, or going to Cloquet and to Harbors, in both schools, they talked about doing that. And then in the home visiting levy, we have also gone back to the 320. And I know that the one of the most important features of the ECFE program is the fact that our school personnel and volunteers and staff go out into the community and do outreach and bring in these families that might not have otherwise taken part in it. And that is so important. And that was being dramatically cut back. So that is why that is there. The amendment says, if you look in the next section, section number 5, the Commissioner of Education shall develop a plan to expand the developmental assessment. We're actually in the amendment saying the Commissioner of Education shall implement a kindergarten readiness assessment. So we're not asking to develop a plan. We're saying implement it. We're already there. And then, I don't know what that is. And then in addition, it's very important that people know that the kindergarten readiness program is voluntary. So therefore, the amendment also puts, as we list each of these fiscal years, puts the words up to 30% and up to 50% so that it's clear that we are not requiring 30%, but yet we're allowing the funds to go up to in each of those cases. And then finally, section number 6 is parent education grants. We know that ECFE is not the only program out there reaching out to these at-risk communities. And so this section of the bill allows other organizations that are already in existence and serving this needs to have access to funding as well. And they have to, again, be accountable, show that they are meeting our standards in order to receive funds. And so I have people with me to testify about the ECFE program, and then actually from my districts to talk about what they're doing with ECFE. So the first person I have testifying in the order.
Gail.
Thank you.
Very good.
Madam Chair and committee members, I want to thank you for this opportunity.
For the record, your full name?
I'm sorry. I'm Gail Southwell. I'm coordinator of early childhood programming for the Osseo School District, which is District 279. And I want to talk a little bit about the changes that we've seen in the families that we are serving in the last 6 years, and that's when I took over as coordinator. And it's not due to me. It's due to the changing needs of our families and the outreach that we're doing. In addition to the typical ECFE classes that many of us are familiar with that have been offered to families for the last 30 years in our district, we're doing some real specific types of activities and classes and programming to meet the varying needs and the changing needs of our demographic parents. And we have changed in our district in the last 10 years from being a middle-class white suburban school district to now where we are over 40% families of color. And that's a great challenge to early childhood programming. But we are doing that by providing many family literacy classes. We're doing teen parent classes in our high schools, as well as our alternative learning center, as well as North Vista. We are doing bilingual classes weekly for our Hmong population and our Spanish-speaking population. We are offering teen parenting classes at high schools and going out to do hugs visits or new baby visits with some of the parents. We offer weekly classes for dads, for dad and I, dad and toddler classes, as well as for single parents. We do classes for children with special needs by providing the parent education component in a coffee gathering. Also, we do many of our classes, over 11 classes of our ECFE classes are collaboratively taught and include children with special needs in there. And parents are coming to those classes with their children. We have many families that have multiple stresses going on in their lives, especially with mental health and with postpartum depression. And working with those families to provide them a connection, someone that can help steer them to the correct services. And we're doing that on a weekly basis. We offer classes in some of our low-income housing. We're not doing it as much as we'd like to because of the cost of those, but we are still providing that for some of our apartment complexes. I talked about our diverse population, and with that, we have to provide interpreters. And we have Hmong daycare providers that are coming on site and using our facilities. We have a Spanish-speaking class where we've had to add a second class. Now we are looking at adding a third class with a parent component. They continue to come to us because of court mandated, and so they will have to participate in a parent class, and ECFE is a local program that can provide that. We are not doing it, but I know that there are some ECFE programs in the state that are doing programming at homeless shelters and at transitional housing units. Our home visiting program continues the need continues to exceed what we can provide, and we are looking at many parents who are not comfortable coming into an educational setting, that many families are, mother is on bed rest, and just trying to provide a program now for a mother who has just is recuperating from a major stroke and cannot drive, and so she wants her child to have that experience, and so other parents in that group are providing her transportation so that she and her child can participate and plan on doing that next year, and the bond that she has created with those families will never fail her. We do collaboration with Head Start in helping them get the kindergarten connection and the transitions ready for those children. We work with churches. We're working with moms groups. We're working with child care providers for doing some training for them, wanting to do a lot more, and they're asking for more, but we cannot, with our limited funds, provide as much as they would want. We're doing a lot. Elementary schools are now looking at us for transition activities and providing those connections for families. We work with other agencies in the community with resource fairs and events, things like some of our local churches where we provided some programming for their African population. We work with Success by Six. We're working with the Interagency of Special Ed. We are doing hospital visits. We are doing new baby visits in homes. And we continue to work with the libraries to do new baby story times with them. So the additional funds or the restoration of funds will allow us to continue to expand those to those families that are most needs, those families that have stress factors in their lives, but also there are stress factors in many middle-class and upper-class families that they are overwhelmed by all of the demands and not having family to fall back on, and ECFE also provides that.
I thank you. And I'm going to have to take a lesson from Senator Torres Ray and ask Senator Bonhoff if she wants to move her amendment A1.
Oh, thank you. I move the A1 amendment.
The amendment has been moved. Those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
As opposed? Thank you. Now
thank
we can
you.
Move on to your...
And I do just want to be respectful of everybody who came so far to testify, and I know we do have to end in 10 minutes, so I'd ask each testifier to just, you know, give us your highlights. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoff, I was prepared to talk about the kindergarten assessment right now, and I wanted to have the opportunity to talk about that, and I'm a little confused. Are we talking about the parent education grants? Are any of the witnesses going to talk about the kindergarten assessment recommendation?
Madam Chair, the kindergarten assessment is going to the witness to talk about that is Karen Cadigan, and so these people are up here to, I thought up here to only talk about the ECFE program.
Okay.
So I would suggest that we save that. It sounds like we're not going to get through this whole bill today. Right. And so if you wouldn't mind letting them talk about ECFE in their schools.
Okay. So just for my, excuse me, Madam Chair.
This bill contains all three provisions. It's the restoring the cuts to ECFE, providing the funding for the kindergarten assessment, pre-kindergarten assessment, and the parent education grants.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to get clarification on those three parts.
And
thank
Senator Bonhoff is correct. We will have to pick up the next part of the bill on Wednesday, but we should at least get through these witnesses this evening.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I missed your name from Formacio, but there was just two clarifications of could you just say a word about how you initiate the home visits? I mean, how you do that? And the second was you made a reference to court. Some people are court mandated to participate
yes.
in ECFE. Could you say a tad more?
They are required to take parent education classes, and ECFE is one of the programs where allows them to do that. And so we just need to verify that they have participated in a parent education program.
So Madam Chair, then they are being court mandated. Why? I mean...
It could be going through a divorce, and that's typically what we have seen.
Okay.
Okay. The other piece that you asked was more information about how we identify our families for home visits.
And initiate them.
Initiate them. We have a parent educator who is at North Memorial and does some outreach there, and she connects with families there. We have nurses, pediatricians that are connecting. They could be referrals from early childhood special education or from the home visiting nurses that go out. And then we also are involved in a program called HUGS, Helping Us Grow. And they have they make contacts with families that are – we have some volunteers that do phone calling to new parents, or we send out a card indicating if they'd like a home visit or a contact. So there's several ways that we're doing that.
So, Madam Chair, what I meant was, so you are asking parents if they would like to participate or like to have this
yes.
connection.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and committee members. My name is Joyce Beard. I am the Family Literacy Director for the Robbinsdale Area Schools. Robbinsdale has one of the largest family literacy programs in the state. I just have three key points that I wanted to make today. Number one, the ELL numbers in our district are exploding. I believe it's gone from 1 in 100 to 1 in 10 in the last 5 years. The poverty level for children in our district is approaching 40% now. The waiting lists for family literacy are commonplace and are mostly by word of mouth. I cannot do outreach because I don't want to give families false hope. I ask you to consider the implications of the large numbers of non-English-speaking families moving into the school system. I think it's very eye-opening when you experience working with parents who have never held a scissors themselves or know how to form letters themselves. It's important to realize the importance of providing services for the whole family in these cases that family literacy and ECFE provides. Currently, there is no dedicated state dollars for family literacy. Family literacy programs are currently funded through ECFE and adult basic education collaboratives.
Thank you. And is
you're from Robinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for having me. My name is Emma McCready. I have been in the U.S. for 10 years. I was born in Liberia. I have three children, 29 years old and 1 4-year old. I wanted to come here today to talk about the ECFE program and how it has been beneficial for my family. I first learned of ECFE when I received a brochure through the mail. The brochure stated parent discussion groups, and I was interested in the parenting groups because at the time I was struggling with 3-year-old interactions. I attended these classes and then was told by a staff member about a family literacy program that was also offered through ECFE. I decided to attend family literacy in order to continue with the ECFE components and parent discussion and yet work towards preparing myself for a better job. Through the adult basic education component in family literacy, I have been able to learn keyboarding and computer skills, complete resumes, and learn how to interview for jobs. Through the early childhood component, my child has learned to socialize better with other children and has become more independent. She will start kindergarten in the fall and already knows all of her letters, many numbers, and writes her name and attempts to write other things as well. The books and other literacy items brought on home visits have been very helpful in order to provide materials for my husband and me to help prepare our child more for school. Parent education has taught me that I'm not alone and have gained from others in the group who are experiencing situations that I too have faced. It has been very helpful to learn suggestions from others in my parent discussion groups. I now realize I am my child's first teacher, and I also realize that being involved in your child's school is important. I feel a part of my child's learning and feel that my child is more prepared to learn because I'm involved with them. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming.
My name is Kristen Christofferson, and I chair the Wayzata Family Learning Center Advisory Committee, which includes our ECFE program, school readiness, and our preschool peppermint fence. I second what's already been said here, but want to talk a little bit more about the parent as educator, the primary teacher of our kids. I am a West Suburban middle-class woman who has a long education, and nothing that I learned in the university taught me how to be a parent. Luckily, I have extended family who helped me, but when I really needed it, I turned to ECFE, and it made me, I think, a good parent even better. It makes great parents even more excellent. But with extended funding, you'll be able to make frustrated parents calmer, isolated parents connected, and just a better community for our kids and for our neighborhoods. We live in an era where we don't know our neighbors, and this is one of the ways that we do get to know at least people who have children our children's age. Once you get to school, as you're about to experience, you get to know those other parents, but that's not till they're 5. That's a long way from 0 to 5. So if you have a chance to do it in ECFE, your child has a more seamless education to get to preschool, which makes them better prepared for kindergarten, which makes them better prepared for everything, as you probably already know. So I just want to say that, yes, those of us in the western suburbs may be viewed as people who already have the resources for ECFE, but as you've heard, our suburbs are changing as well. I have many classmates I've been with, both in my time in Wayzata and I started in St. Paul, who came from outstate Minnesota, who said if it wasn't for ECFE, they would have been very lonely in the small towns that they were living in with their small children. So I really encourage you to forward this and extend the funding as much as you can. Thank you.
Madam
Senator
Chair, I just want to thank my witnesses for being here today. And as many of you probably have, I've visited the ECFE programs at all, in all of my districts, and it's the one visit where I always leave crying because you hear the stories from the parents and how these programs have touched them, and they really are very powerful. So if there's one program that we ought to for sure keep funding, it's ECFE. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator, and witnesses. Because so many of us have to move on to Burnsville this afternoon, we're going to adjourn our committee. And
Madam Chair, excuse me, I know two of the witnesses also were here to talk about the parent grant things, and I don't know if they are able to come back. I'm wondering how you want to handle that.
That's a good.
Oh, they're very generous. They are able to come back.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who is not able to come back that was supposed to testify today? Thank you, Senator Tabana, for bringing that up. So with that, I'd like to adjourn the meeting, and we would resume on Wednesday a discussion of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Hi. Do you have a MapQuest or any directions for getting to Burnsville? If she's gone, I don't know her.
We'll run up and get yeah.
No, it may be back there, but I haven't been in my office since I left this morning. So I've got to come over here, and I don't get back there.
I'm going to try to get down there.
I've got a transportation. I've got a transportation.
Yeah.
That's how you get down there?
No. It's actually not that
bad. Wow.
Family went to your superintendent.
You're like Friday's a long time
away. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's about...
I wonder what.